Steve Stewart from Carnegie Mellon, and he is an economist who works in the area of privacy.
Thank you, George. I will be talking about the economics of privacy and the behavioral economics of privacy, and because George has been so eloquent, more eloquent than I could ever be in describing some of the works we are doing together, and because this is also the first session, the first talk immediately after lunch, I decided to go picture heavy and text light. So I will try to show how I moved from these to this, much to the disappointment of my PhD advisor. Actually, the idea is the previous slide is about the economics of privacy. The second slide, which I will explain in a few minutes, is about the behavioral economics of privacy. So I'll get back to this. And also about the fact that even the behavioral economics of privacy really deals a lot with mathematics as well. So economics of privacy. It focuses on privacy as information revelation or information protection, although yes, we know privacy means many different things. Daniel Solow, a couple of years ago, wrote this beautiful paper on the taxonomy of privacy, listing, I believe, 17 different interpretations of privacy. But what economists try to do, when they focus on privacy as information revelation, they try to understand the trade-offs associated with the protection or the disclosure of data. Although they also understand that privacy per se is neither universally good or bad for the subject. It depends on what privacy, what amount of information we are talking about, what context. So around the early 80s, in fact, late 70s, early 80s, the Chicago School was a place where the first type of work on economics and privacy started. The position there, researchers like Stigler or Posner, was that privacy is creates inefficiencies in the marketplace. Privacy in general, on average, is bad because it removes information which will be useful to market players. Around 20 years later, there has been a revival of the economics of privacy, most likely because of the growth of the internet and the new amount of information revelation made possible by information technology. And this has led to microeconomic modeling of the type I was showing in my first picture. Those equations came from a paper I wrote with Alverian about price discrimination in privacy, so rational agents deciding when to provide, when to protect information, corporations being interested in the data, and so on and so forth. So there was, however, a problem that many of these models we were working on assumed this abstract, rational economic agent that many of you are familiar with, the agent which maximizes future utility, discounts in a time-consistent way, has consistent preferences, knows about the states of the world, and so on and so forth. Well, in fact, we know that such a description of a pure rational agent, while not necessarily absurd, also does not capture many real-life instances of human behavior. And in particular, in the area of privacy, significant dichotomies between attitudes and behavior has been shown. The dichotomy between attitudes and behavior is known by social psychologists in pretty much every field, but in the privacy area, it's particularly funny to study. So to give an example, a couple of years ago, Ralph Gross, a student at CMU, and I started working on information revelation on the Facebook. We were interested in how people use the Facebook, how much they reveal, how much they realize they reveal, and so on and so forth. We found many, many results. One of these was that there is this strong dichotomy between what people believe they are revealing and what they are, how much they want to reveal and what they actually reveal. So we found, for instance, that measuring on a Likert scale, 1 to 7, how concerned people, members of the Facebook, were about, for instance, their address and their scheduled classes being known by a complete stranger, or their political and sexual orientation and the name of their partners were to be known by strangers, well, the people who were selecting the highest point in the concern scale, on a Likert scale, were also likely to reveal that information anyway on the Facebook. So on the 7-point, on this 7-point Likert scale, 60% were revealing information that they claimed they would be very concerned if it were known to strangers. If we relax And we check not just the seventh, the highest concern level, but the sixth and the seventh point, meaning people who were extremely concerned or quite concerned. These numbers go up to almost 50%, meaning 50% of the people had the dichotomy between what they claimed to be concerned about and what they were actually doing. So why? Well, there is not one single explanation. It's such an interesting and complex phenomenon. There is a measure, an issue of incomplete information. Some people may not realize what they are revealing and to how many people. There is an issue of bounded rationality. Even if you know how much you are revealing to whom, you don't spend your time or your day thinking about every possible ramification, such as a decision tree, like a program, a software would work. Think about every single implication of every single piece of information, revelation you have on the internet. And then even if you had complete information and unbounded computational cognitive power to think through every possible ramification of your choices, well, there are still all these cognitive and behavioral biases that people like George, as well as many other behavior economists, have been studying for the past 20 to 30 years. And here I make a list of a number of studies that we have been doing, a number of phenomena that we have been studying, and for which we have found suggestive evidence of their existence and their influence on privacy decision-making. Hyperbolic discounting, herding behavior, what other people reveal, impacts what you will reveal, optimism bias, coherent arbitrariness, framing effect. So let me give an example of a framing effect. The framing here was, we wanted to study how people value the same bit, the same piece of information, very differently, depending on whether you frame it as do you want to protect this piece of data or do you want to reveal this piece of data. So this was a real experiment in outside the lab. It was in the field. We call it the gift card study because we were asking to mall patrons in a shopping center, to choose between two different type of cards. A $10 anonymous card, meaning that the card could not be tracked to their identity and the transaction, the purchases made with this gift card would be effectively anonymous. And a $12, $2 more, identified card, meaning that the card and the transactions done with the card could be tracked back to the identity of the person receiving the card. By the way, this is work with George and with Leslie. There are four conditions between subject design, but really what I'm focusing here is only two conditions, these two endowment conditions. In one condition, we first gave to subjects a $10 anonymous card for participating in another study, which we didn't care about, actually. And then after they had completed the study and done other things, we would offer them the choice of switching to a $12 card, okay, identified. In the other condition, we started from the $12 card. We gave the $12 identified card first. Then the subjects in that condition did whatever they had to do for the other study. And then eventually they were offered to switch to a $10 anonymous card. Okay? So effectively, the decision process, the problem was exactly the same for a rational agent. The decision was to choose between do you want a gift card, which allows you to buy whatever you want on the internet, which is valuable $10, and will protect your privacy, because every transaction will be anonymous. Or do you want a card which is worth $12, however, it's also trackable, and the purchases will be tracked to your name. The selection was exactly the same in the two cases, however, and I would ask you to concentrate only on the first, left, and right, the last columns. The selection of cards was completely different depending on which card was offered first. So on the y-axis, we represent the percentage of people who chose the $10 anonymous card. For the people in the condition which started from a $10 card, well, around 52% stick to that card. For the people who started with an endowed card of $12, only 9% switch to the $10. What it means? It means that around half the people who started from an anonymous condition remain in that anonymous condition. However, if you start from an identified condition, only 9% want to switch to the anonymous condition. In other words, depending on how you frame the problem, would you like $2 to give away your data versus would you pay $2 to protect your data? You will have a completely different decision. This is an example of this framing effect. It's also connected, obviously, to endowment effect studies and willingness to pay versus willingness to attend. Now, this does not mean that privacy behavior is random, completely irrational, doesn't change over time. It's not random. There are important factors which affect sensitivities to privacy. Here is another Facebook study. We show how the percentage of people who decide to make their profile visible within a sort of Facebook network depends on the size of the network. If in networks which are very large, such as LA network, around 60% of people decide to make their profiles visible. In networks which are very small, relatively speaking, there is a much higher percentage of people decide to make their profile visible. Another example. Preferences are not immutable. They change over time. This is a CMU network over time. This is around 120 days between 2007 and 2008, during which Facebook privacy issues got lots of attention in the media because there were a number of changes in the system, such as the beacon, advertising proposal, and so on and so forth. It shows the percentage of people who make their profile visible. It's not 0 to 100%. We kind of magnified to highlight the change, and we see how over time, almost perfectly linear relationship, over time, fewer and fewer people were making their profile visible. So there were changes inside the network about how people wanted to be visible. So this shows not that people are irrational, completely irrational, but that we need to understand the motivations for that behavior and that behavior economics can be useful for that. And I conclude with an example of one area that is, to me, very, very interesting, and one area that does require the usage of psychology and behavior economics if we want to understand what is happening, and it's the area of a bad reputation. And I go back to the picture I showed in the beginning. So this picture came out on the Daily Mail in the UK, and I cannot fake a good British accent.
Is it a royal or is it somebody regular?
Sorry?
Is it a royal or is it somebody regular?
Somebody regular, although you could guess. The Ladesu glorified a shameful drunken antics on Facebook. So there is a group on the Facebook called 30 Reasons Girls Should Call It a Night, in which a female post photos of themselves passed out, drunken, even vomiting. It's not ex-boyfriends. It's not the angry former boyfriend who is posting the photo. It's the person himself, herself. Okay. In from thesalon.com, this quote from one lady who did post the photo and found herself becoming a minor celebrity for one day. And she concludes saying, well, almost famous, I guess. So there is this need for bad reputation. And again, what is the reason? Many reasons. Because this bad reputation to us, actually to your peer group, could be a good reputation. You are signaling that you are a party goer, you like to party hard, and so on and so forth. You are not considering possibly the long-run effect of this information revelation. But then again, this is all so new. So let me conclude with this picture, the three last pictures, to discuss whether this is so new or not. Sasha and Leslie, probably you guys saw already this picture, so you don't need to answer this. Anybody else? Do you recognize at all? Can you guess where this picture was taken? Where? Location? Sorry? Great. Fantastic, exactly. This is what remains of this, the temple of Diana, Artemis, in Ephesus, which at the time was a Greek colony, what we in Italy we call Magna, in Latin was called Magna Graecia. So this temple was reduced to this state, this condition, not by weather, not by a war, by fire of one single individual. This individual wanted to remain famous, and decided that the best way to remain famous was to destroy what was at the time one of the ancient miracles of architecture. So the citizens of Ephesus captured him, killed him, and also condemning to what Latins call damnatio memoriae, damnation of memory, removing every single instance of his name from any possible documents. It so happened that the historian Strabus was able actually to save the name somehow, so we know that the name was Erostratus, or Erostratus. So this Erostratus wanted to be...
Did you just break Roman law at this point?
Sorry?
Did you just break Greek and Roman law by saying that?
Yeah. Oh my God! Caesar will go after me. So this Erostratus wanted to remain famous even for something bad. Now, why am I showing this? Because I'm showing this to show that there is this need for fame as well as need for publicity, which coexists. It's not necessarily in contradiction, but coexists with our need for privacy. Not only that, but this is true today on Facebook, as it was true then. And I stop here because I already exhausted my time. Thanks.
Worked when I tested it before. There we go. I can both see it and you can see it. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about privacy engineering, which is where I've come to after quite a broad detour, somewhat into left field. I started out as a PhD student and a researcher in mathematical computing. Having started to teach social, legal and ethical aspects of computer and communication technology, I ended up doing research in it as well and went off to do a Master's in Law to support my research in that. Now, I cover a huge gamut of things, including security, computer security in that. But my principal funding at the moment comes from the EU to provide ethical inputs to security development, technology development programmes. This isn't computer security I'm focusing on, it's societal security, anti-terrorism, anti-crime technology development. Now, my principal focus in this area is privacy, but I also do look at the other ethical implications. One of the ones I look at on that is the embedding of bias into the technology development. So are we developing racist or sexist technology, which is going to have massive implications for those on whom this has impact? Shameless plug, I'm the author of a book, principally an undergraduate textbook, on this whole range of social, legal and ethical issues. So what I've come back to now, after this long diversion off into anthropology, psychology, sociology and law, is I'm coming back to engineering now with the fruits of that diversion. And I'm looking at what I'm calling a whole system approach to privacy engineering. And as I've come through these numerous projects on security technology development, I keep having to step back even further and say, well, what's the whole system? First, I thought it was just that the technology developers were ignoring the people in the equation. They were focusing solely on the technology and not looking at either the people it was applied to nor the people who were using it. But then I had to keep stepping back further and further and actually decide that when you're talking about security technology, and particularly how you preserve privacy when security technology is being deployed, that actually the whole system is society, because you can't get away from the political element of security, which we've been talking about quite a lot over the last day and a half, which is that there is this sense that privacy and security are a zero-sum game. And security is something that particularly politicians keep saying the primary goal of, or the primary requirement on government, is to keep their citizens secure. And therefore, anything that gets in the way of that must give way. Now, one of the things is privacy and security are not a zero-sum game. Particularly on an individual level, our own security partly will depend on having our own privacy. When you have all your details out there available for anybody to see, you are vulnerable to impersonation. that's a significant threat to your own individual security. Now, privacy is often misconstrued as secrecy. You hear the phrase, which I really dislike, if you've nothing to hide, you've nothing to fear. And anyone who's seen that come out of the mouths of British politicians will have found it very amusing that just recently British politicians have been fighting a rearguard action against having their own expenses published and making those subject to the freedom of information. Now, looking back at the way security technology and its impact on privacy has been being developed in the UK over the last 15 years, and I'm sure you all know that the UK has more CCTV cameras per head of population than anywhere else in the world, by far. We far outstrip any even of the most oppressive regimes in the world in number of CCTV cameras. And I've been looking recently at how we got to that position. There's been some work on how we got there. There's been some work on the political discourse analysis of this. And what I found is that it's very difficult to talk about enhancing privacy in the context of the highly emotive case. Now, the two that really came out with this recently is the case of James Bulger, who, very sad case, a young toddler who was murdered by some other young boys, aged 10 and 11, I believe it was. Now, the abduction of the boy from a shopping mall was captured on CCTV. It was part of the investigation and the prosecution that this event was captured on CCTV. And the results of that, when you look at the political ramifications at the time, are that suddenly they were saying, oh, CCTV is good and necessary because it will prevent crime. Pardon? I'm sorry. There was an abduction of a toddler who was murdered, captured on CCTV. He was murdered. It didn't prevent the crime. Yes, it may have made it easier to investigate the crime. It may have made it easier to prosecute and convict the perpetrators, but it didn't stop the crime. So where suddenly does this idea come from that putting CCTV cameras up prevents crime? And if you talk to more knowledgeable police about this in the UK, they'll say, actually, yes, our goal in getting CCTV put in places is for investigation purposes, sometimes for prosecution, but mainly for investigation purposes. It's useful to be able to look back in time. But unfortunately, we can't justify that to people. So we've got to follow the politician's line of, this helps prevent crime. Another example of this, Sharon Bezhnevsky, again, quite a sad case. She was a recently qualified policewoman in Bradford. She was murdered as part of an armed robbery. She was responding to an armed robbery and shot by the perpetrators. One of the perpetrators of this, at least one, it may have been two actually, one of the perpetrators of this was tracked using automatic number plate recognition down to London and was then arrested following the tracking of the vehicle that he'd been driving from Bradford down to London. This was the first time it had been admitted that the National Traffic Monitoring System, which was put in place with the claim that it was only for the purpose of improving the traffic flow on the roads, to improve the response of emergency services to accidents on the road. It was put in place for the benefit of the public. That was the claim. And then ANPR was added to it quietly in the background by the police, and it wasn't admitted, although there were some claims that this was going on, it wasn't admitted until there was a major emotive case which they could say, look, we solved this case because we had this ANPR tracking the movements of every single vehicle going around the UK. With that sort of political messing around, it's almost impossible to argue for privacy. And actually, when you look at this, and as I say, you look at things like the claim that CCTV reduces crime, when no, it just makes it easier to investigate in certain circumstances, you realise security is not actually the goal, I think. Power is the goal. They don't really want to improve security. They may claim that. What they actually want is power. So just a couple of graphics to lighten the mood. So that's something of a tirade against those in power. This one was reminded yesterday about the abilities of users and how we must target our goals on computer security users, and then the follow-up to this for user-friendly. And if you're just reading the speech bubbles there, have a look at the guy in the background on the computer. Mm-hmm. Incoming mail, opening email. Click, 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 click. And finally, a follow-up to the very interesting talk this morning about documentary photography. There are thousands of people taking photographs in London every day. What if one of them has evil intent? This one was such a ripe, ridiculous campaign for parody that there are quite a number of them. And something I put in early and decided to skip. This is the one of the many, many parodies of that poster. And I think that sums up my my feeling about this, about that particular campaign wonderfully well. Thank you very much.
That's cute.
Okay, the next speaker is Peter Neumann.
Yes. Thank you very much. I have a couple of topics that I want to raise. There are probably four topics I think I can do with the mic. Wouldn't hurt. Scrunch. Thank you, Matt. Okay. Privacy is really in the eye of the beholder. And to most people, privacy is not something they realize they even had until they lose it. So I think one of the key problems here is that we have to examine the difference between security of computer systems and networks and privacy. And my first slide here says privacy is largely extrinsic. Inside the machine, we talk about secrecy, we talk about confidentiality, we talk about integrity of data and integrity of systems and things like that. But once the information has gotten outside of the system and it's no longer under the purview of access controls and authentication and audit trails and so on, essentially the privacy problem really kicks in spades. Now, if we had, this is the old story about if we had ham, we could have ham and eggs if we had eggs. If we had computer security that was meaningful, which we don't, we could have security and privacy together if we had privacy. But we don't have privacy either. So we're in a bit of a bind, and my fundamental mixed metaphor is this one. Pandora strikes again here. Pandora's cat is out of the barn, and the genie won't go back in the closet. First time I used this in public, I think, was at an RSA conference, and I was referring to export controls and crypto, but it seems to apply to a lot of things, so I tossed it in here as well. And what we really have is that... privacy, once something is out of the system, is impossible to put back in the system because you have no way of knowing where it went. So I wanted to give you one paradigmatic example of a problem which has enormous security implications but also has enormous privacy implications. And that is the electronic voting system problem. Which really requires voter confidentiality, voter privacy, vote privacy, vote integrity, system integrity, non-subvertible audit trails, non-refutable dispute resolution, forensics, all sorts of things. And at the moment, what we have is a system in which every step in the entire process is a weak link. The DOD loves to talk about strength and depth. We have weakness and depth. We basically have a structure in which everything is a problem. And privacy is one of the real clinkers in this pot. If we did not want our votes to be private, some of the system problems could be solved more readily. On the other hand, the real problem is that then you get issues of vote selling and coercion and all sorts of horrible problems that result if you don't have some sense of privacy in your vote. Now, the real problem here is that not only are we talking about what's inside the systems, we're talking about everything else the voter registration process, which has been seriously compromised. Authentication of voters, where in Florida in 2000, some voters in minority districts were asked for 3 pieces of identification, and others were asked for none. The Caltech MIT study said something between 4 and 6 million voters were disenfranchised as a result of one shenanigan or another. The vote counting process, the certification process, the recounting, resolving disputes, all of this stuff is a weak link. But the real clinker here, and I'll come back to it in a later context when I look at the effects of the Salzer-Schroeder security principles on this whole process, is the fact that the software is proprietary, the evaluations of the software are proprietary, they're paid for by the vendor, the data inside the machines is proprietary, the data formats are themselves proprietary, and you get to the point where you have a disputed election and there's almost nothing that can be done because there are no audit trails. So then people come along and say, now we're going to have internet voting, and you can vote from anywhere, from your laptop. You can download some software which purports to be the authentic voting software, and now you can vote, and your vote's going to be counted correctly, and nobody else is going to know how you voted, and so on. So this is a problem that really pulls together the security issues of the integrity of the system and the confidentiality of the system and all of the privacy problems that are outside of the computer system's purview. The voluntary standards have been in the past almost worthless. The evaluations are completely simplistic. And until the last item on this thing, which was last summer's California Secretary of State's top-to-bottom review of what was going to be 4 machines, they wound up with 3 different vendors. One vendor refused to play in this process and was immediately thrown out and said, none of your systems will count. Until that review showed in essentially every single one of the reports that was written, that this stuff is so terribly bad from the point of view of computer security, that privacy is almost irrelevant. You can't solve, you can't even begin to look at the privacy problems if you can't solve the security problems. So I think it's the synergy of the security and the privacy together that is important here. There are lots of opportunities for crypto solutions, if you could believe them. There are lots of problems that arise from absentee ballots and vote selling and coercion and the fact that the process is inherently political. And there's an enormous gap between what can be done in the research community and what is done in practice in the actual systems. Now, I wanted to very quickly mention the Salzer-Schroeder principles, which basically, even though they came out of Multics in the 60s, and which were published in 75, describe a bunch of things like separation of privilege and least privilege and so on, fail-safe defaults and so on, that all of these things would contribute, if they were used in some systematic way, to the trustworthiness of the computer system. When I say trustworthiness, as I mentioned yesterday, I mean reliability, security, availability, survivability in the face of all kinds of accidents and denial of service attacks, interoperability so that you could actually compose the system out of pieces of different vendors, which you can't do today. And so all of these principles are in fact really relevant to trustworthiness of the computer systems. Unfortunately, they are much less relevant when it comes to the privacy issues. For example, the Schroeder-Salzer principle of recording whenever there's a compromise, you should have enough information so you can go back and figure out what happened. You really would like to record everything. You want an audit trail that describes every time a vendor has gone in and modified the software. In one of the recent elections in California, Diebold had 17 counties in which they were providing the software. In every one of those 17 counties, the software that was used was not the certified software. They'd subsequently gone in and modified it. So you want an audit trail, really, that describes everything. And when it comes to privacy, you'd like an audit trail that says who has had access to this data, who's changed it, who is misleading you by putting up bogus data. And the problem, again, is once the Pandora's cat is out of the barn, you have no way of having any authentication or any forensics. Now, there's some cryptographic techniques that would provide integrity checks and things like that on data. But once it's gotten out of the machine and it's photographed, and it's photographed off the screen and it has no authentication associated with it, those techniques don't work anymore. Another one that would certainly make sense is the open design of Sulzer and Schroeder, but it needs to be extended to the openness of the entire process. And unless you have oversight of essentially every step along the way, you have no hope of ensuring either security or privacy. I have two more slides. One relates to some of the novel cryptography that can, in fact, have a relationship with privacy. And the first one is identity-based encryption. Dan Bonet and others have worked on this. The second one is what's called attribute-based encryption, which is largely Brent Waters and his colleagues. They've essentially generalized role-based access controls and applied them to cryptography so that you effectively have attributes that are generalization of roles, and you're providing crypto keys for the different attributes that somebody might have. For example, a doctor with a certain specialty. If you wanted to send a piece of email to every doctor with that specialty in a particular hospital environment, you could do that with one crypto key. It would be an encrypted message, and it would have an attribute-based encryption key associated with it. This has been generalized now into a thing called functional cryptography. Again, Brent Waters, who's at SRI. And again, let me caution that even if we had all this wonderful crypto and we had all these wonderful computer systems, we still have the problem that all of this stuff is vulnerable to human beings, and that's the subject of this workshop. The Diebold stuff is put on top of a Windows XP system, where everybody who has any involvement with that system knows the master key. The crypto key in the system has been the same for 10 years. It's never changed. It was reported 10 years ago, and the same key is still in the software. Anybody who has access to that key and the XP key can do absolutely anything to a voting machine, even during the election. So we have a fundamental problem that even if we had wonderful computer security, we might not be able to trust it. And finally, I wanted to respond to a comment that was made earlier this morning about global thinking versus local thinking. There's a two-page paper on my website, holistic.pdf. And what I did is I tried to look at the energy situation, the agricultural situation, healthcare, where we'd really like much greater attention to preventive care, as we see in European countries and China and elsewhere, rather than this palliative cure thing where they pretend they're going to give you something that will solve your problem, but it's going to create 17 other problems because of the side effects from the drugs, which are, in fact, effects. And I wrote in this article about how one might apply holistic techniques of principled system development, whereby we could really come up with trustworthy systems that were meaningfully secure, reliable, available, survivable, interoperable, extendable, replaceable in pieces, and so on. And so I think there is a very important argument here that needs to be made, relating to the fact that if you look at some of the economic situations that Ross has been working on for a long time, if you look at some of the system usability issues and you factor those into your architecture and your system design, you come up with a radically different solution than the one you have today. And if I go back to the voting case, it is absolutely clear that if this system or these systems were designed by people in the research community, we would have voting machines with some integrity in them. The fact that they're built by people in one case, one of the companies' voting machine subsidiary has five convicted felons working for them, you wonder whether any of this stuff is in fact legitimate. So with that as my introduction, I hope we have lots of time left for discussion. I think this is an enormously critical area, and I look forward to the discussion. Thanks very much.
Yes, thank you very much. Actually, as of today, I'm no longer with the Digital Technology Center. Well, actually, I am, but I'm no longer a director of it. And so I am now able to work harder on the project I'll be describing. I'll be just collecting information on for a while. Let's see, this is supposed to work. Yes, it goes. Okay, good. Just one more adjustment. Full screen mode. Okay. So the project I'll be devoting next half a year to, almost full time, is writing a book comparing the internet bubble to the British Railway Manual of the 1840s. Now, what I'm really interested in is the conflict between kind of economic incentives, standard economic model, and human preferences. And that has many implications for security and other issues. And looking at things such as the bubbles, especially the railways or the internet, is quite enlightening because you have a new impetus, a new factor showing up, which kind of disturbs the traditional setup. And then you can observe how does society react. Okay. Well, why is the British Railway Manual of the 1840s? Well, that was not my original project. That one is on a back burner, has to do with study of price discrimination and its likely influence in the future. I'll get back to it, but I simply stumbled onto this particular incident, which is very interesting. It's the greatest technology bubble in history. You're talking about a still fairly primitive society in the early stages of the Industrial Revolution that was devoting, compared to the size of U.S. economy today, about $1.2 trillion per year to capital investment. I'm not talking about astronomical stock market valuations kind of blown out of hot air. I'm talking about real capital investment, paying people to kind of dig tunnels, build embankments and ditches and so on. Okay? Huge, huge effort. It's the only, by far the greatest technology manual that I've been able to find any place. It's the only time I've been able to find in recent European history, meaning back, going back, say, five centuries, when individual capitalists, in pursuit of private profit, put more money into building out a public infrastructure than the nation was putting into the military. Normally, there's no comparison. In the internet bubble U.S., the most kind of outrageous waste was in the long-haul fiber construction in the United States. That was a grand total of about $100 billion. Now, $100 billion is quite a lot when you compare it to the size of grants that people like us here get, etc. But in the grand scheme of things, it's 1% of GDP, really trivial. In the Brits' case, I mean, it was like total cumulative investment in railways by 1850, when everybody was despairing, financial outcomes. Total investment was like $6 trillion, and they had lost about $2 trillion. But this was giant. I mean, railways were the giant new industry, and it really shook up the whole kind of economy and society. Here is kind of one cartoon from Punch. I'll have a bunch of other ones. Railway juggernaut of 1845. Another example showing how seriously they took it, this is a cartoon of Queen Victoria and her husband, Prince Albert. Okay? Queen turns to him and says, "Momentous question. Tell me, oh tell me, dearest Albert, have you any railway shares?" Because at the height of the mania in 1845, they were kind of really mad about shares. It seemed to be a gold rush. Almost effortless riches were within their reach. It turned out that was wrong. They lost it. They should have known it. There are lots of really kind of delightful analogies between the two bubbles. One is in terms of length of time.
Yes, both were new technologies, both were advanced technologies, but in fact both involved basic civil engineering. And the length of time, the lesson was roughly the same. So United States, you could say that telecom mania, maybe peak was 1998. By 2001, most of these long-haul fiber networks, undersea cables were in place. The insiders kind of saw that there was no demand, but creative accounting, hollow swaps, and other things managed to conceal it for about 1 year. So the final collapse happened in 2002. Okay, so British Railway mania, peak of the excitement is end of 1845. Construction proceeds for about 3 years. In 1848, again, insiders see there's not enough demand, but again, creative accounting conceals for about a year. Real collapse of happens in 1849. Delightful analogies in that case. Okay. But I won't really be talking about this so much. I'll be talking more about some of the kind of more sociological or psychological effects, especially which may have more relevance for security. Okay. So we mentioned collapse comes. This is George Hudson, railway king of Britain, was discovered to be kind of, well, messing around with accounts and stealing his shareholders' money. So he got disgraced in 1849, as precipitates the final collapse of the mania. But some of the more relevant analogies I'll mention is perception of risk. Yesterday, people were talking about, well, are we spending too much time worrying about risk of being bitten by sharks, or risk of airplane parts falling on us, and so on. Okay? Or are we spending too much time worrying about airplanes in general compared to, say, cars? I mean, think about all the money we're spending worrying about terrorism. Yes, 9/11 was terrible. 3,000 people died. I mean, it's a real tragedy, not to belittle it. But every month we lose 3,000 people to car accidents. Okay? So are we overreacting to terrorism or not? Well, railways are a very interesting situation. I mean, it's a simple observation. People do it. I mean, people care much more about terrorism than they do care about car accidents. Railways were a new industry. They gave rise to accidents. And these were kind of topic of major press coverage. Almost every issue you would find, would be another dreadful accident, shocking accident, etc., on particular line. And, it was the little line in an obscure corner of Britain or Ireland would have an accident and would be splashed all over newspapers all over the country. And the railway interest would argue, look, just in London alone, horses kill more people each year than die on railroads in the whole country. Nope. Population still was fixated on rail accidents. Okay, that's what people are. Okay, we can try to explain it, but I mean that's kind of observable fact. Okay? In terms of security. Okay, now what is it that I'm kind of really interested into it? As I mentioned, I was really working on a project which I felt it was kind of very fundamental, and which kind of led me to this railway mania, because it's such a fascinating topic. And that is for price discrimination. So the thing that internet makes possible, or information technology makes possible, is much more intensive form of price discrimination. Okay. Price discrimination means charging different people what they are willing or able to pay. And this is actually a very good example to discuss it, because MIT is a great example of somebody who manages to practice extreme form of price discrimination. You have students here, probably who use this particular lecture room, who pay zero for the education, and others who pay $40,000 per year. Get exactly the same education. That's price discrimination. Okay, and that's been understood to be to lead to maximal production, and it was first understood by people who began studying railway economy. It was a group of French econo-engineers. Jules Dupuy was the deepest thinker among them, who kind of explained, well, they basically developed microeconomics. What they had done was then forgotten and had to be rediscovered about half a century later by other people. But they're definitely pioneers. They really understood all the basic concepts. And here is a beautiful quote from Jules Dupuy. He says, "It is not because of the few thousand francs which have to be spent to put a roof over the third-class carriages or to upholster the third-class seats that some company or other has opened carriages with wooden benches. What the company is trying to do is to prevent the passengers who pay the second-class fare from traveling third-class. It hits the poor not because it wants to hurt them, but to frighten the rich. And it is again for the same reason the companies, having proven almost cruel to the third-class passengers and mean to the second-class ones, become lavish in dealing with first-class passengers. Having refused the poor what is necessary, they give the rich what is superfluous. Okay? This is well understood. The railway companies were not maybe experts in microeconomics, but they understood the basic incentives. You have this new kind of infrastructure, very high fixed costs, relatively low marginal costs. They drove them to price discriminate through versioning. Why? Because they couldn't do it effectively otherwise. What we can do with other technology, though, is providing you get rid of privacy. Privacy is the big obstacle. Is first of all, you can learn what it is that people are willing to pay, or able to pay. Okay. If you say apply to MIT, if you or your parents are willing to pay the full fare, you can preserve your financial privacy. If you want to get a discount, called a scholarship, something or loan, in that case, you have to reveal your very minute financial details. Okay. So what you can do now with the internet, you can find out about people's willingness or ability to pay, and you can control their behavior. Okay. Which of course prevents resale, okay, which is one kind of defense against price discrimination. And that happened. And it's much less cruel than what was happening with airlines, with railroads. And by the way, Dupuy was not exaggerating. Here is a picture from an English, this is not Punch, this is Illustrated London News, of people traveling to Epsom races, first class on top, second class in the middle, and third class in the bottom. Yes, third class were really cattle cars. Uncovered, often put just behind the locomotive so the cinders would fall down on the people, etc. Okay, just to truly frighten the rich. Okay, what MIT is doing is much less cruel. Okay, just find out how much the people are willing or able to pay and take it out of their pockets. Okay, there are really benefits to society of doing it. Promise you run into people's dislike of such practices. Okay, that is. Okay, one of the key elements we find. All the stuff that we hear today about net neutrality, there's nothing particularly new. So there are things that had been done before. The concepts of common carriage were developed over centuries, and they ran into this obstacle of railroads, which had this very strong incentives to price discriminate, which often ran roughshod over the old protections. And that's what led to government regulation. In the United States, first serious federal government involvement in regulation of commerce came in the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887, and that one was designed strictly to control the price discrimination. This is another cartoon from Punch. This is a lesson in zoology. Lady comes with a menagerie of pets, and this official says, railway porter tells her, "Station master say, ma'am, as cats as dogs, and rabbits is dogs, and so is parrots. But this here tortoise is an insect, so there ain't no charge for it." Okay, because railroads were price discriminating according to the rules that Parliament gave them, namely classifying things into certain categories and charging accordingly. Okay? So when I kind of study it, I compare society's reaction to railroads and railroad practices to what we are observing today, is that we're likely to have a major kind of conflict between the economic incentive to price discriminate, which is suddenly visible around here, and human dislike of it. And I don't know exactly where the boundary is. Again, people do learn to accept certain types of price discrimination, such as the tuition breaks that, say, MIT offers to some students. But it develops dislikes of other things. And so it would be very, very interesting to watch. However, remember, the incentives to price discriminate and therefore the incentives to strip away privacy and find out a lot about people are there. And they are going to bedevil any attempts to kind of introduce secure or systems or privacy systems. Okay, thank you.
Okay, the last speaker of this panel is Frank Silvano, who does security photography at Cambridge University. Thank you.
also I entitled this talk From Understanding Technology to Understanding People. I started as the Dilbert that I am by understanding technology, and so the approach to security is, of course, studying all the things like encryption and protocols and logics and access control and formal policies and all that kind of stuff. And I wrote my book about this, and beyond the component level you have the system level, and you study threats and vulnerabilities and all these other good things that give you a global view of the system instead of just the little bits that are fun to develop if you're a coder. And all the things I learned from my mentor here in the audience and my meta-mentor, who was my academic grandfather, is not here anymore, Roger Needham.
But microphone much higher.
Yeah, much higher.
There you go.
Here. Okay. Can you hear me better?
Talk to your lapel. Attached or attached to your ear.
Attached to my beard. Yeah, I did that at one of the security workshops. I had a longer beard at the time. Someone has a photo of that. So that's a good foundation for a security engineer, but something's missing. So over the past few years, I have been looking at how to expand the horizon, and I've started trying to understand people rather than technology. So the first category of people is, of course, experts from other domains other than my own. And I'm not even listing other flavors of engineers. Of course, I have grants with people who are, for example, structural engineers, see the security of having a bridge put up, rigged up with the wireless sensors and all this stuff. But that's not interesting in this context. What I'm talking about is collaborations with people in wildly different sectors, and the ones that I am talking to currently come from these domains. One is bioinformatics and law, and with them we are exploring issues of privacy, what will happen as the shift from genetics to genomics takes place. Genetics is where you look at bits of your DNA, for example, for medical reasons because some genes are associated with some diseases, or for forensic reasons because you want to compare if something that is found at the scene of crime is the same genetic material as someone that you suspect has done something. This is genetics. But genomics is looking not just at specific spots, but at the whole genome, all the billions of bases that are in there, which now is going to become possible very soon because of a tremendous advances, quantitative advances in technology, which make a qualitative difference. When it becomes, you know, these people who are experts in bioinformatics tell me, you know, in a few years, maybe a decade or so, it's plausible to imagine we will pay with $1,000 a full scan of a whole genome. And when this is possible, then there are so many advantages from the medical viewpoint that it's likely that this will happen for everybody at birth, at least in the Western world. So when this happens like that, what are the consequences when this is also used in, for example, in forensics? You're not just comparing those little spots. You have a complete blueprint of the individual. So you can say things about their ancestry. You can say things about their diseases. One of the things we envisaged in this is because the genome is a complete blueprint of the person, you could envisage, I mean, mental experiment, a system where the computer rebuilds, grows a whole individual from the DNA, and you have a slider with the age, and it says, okay, 0, 1 year old, 10 year old, 50 years old, now that's what it looks like, makes a 3D model of it. And all the things that people say, oh, we are anonymizing this data, make no sense in this case. You can just look at it and see who it becomes. So to some extent, a mental experiment, but there's many open questions in this. Within the time allocated, I won't be able to go into detail into any of these things, so I'll just skip to the next item, and that's criminologist. This is a fascinating character, Martin Gill, from whom I learned many things, still trying to set up some collaboration on various projects to investigate fraud. And what his specialty is he goes into prisons, and he interviews convicted criminals. It's a bit like fishing. You have to throw the line many times before you get a bite, but once he builds a rapport with someone, then he really like becomes friend and gets so much out of them, and they are sort of proud of telling him his life story, and he gets fascinating insights. from fraudsters, thieves, even murderers. And I'll tell you something about it on the next page. And the third person I'm associating with is an expert on practical scams who also happens to be a magician, Paul Wilson, and has a wonderful TV program in the UK called The Real Hustle, which I highly recommend you watch. And if you're not in the UK, just look for it on YouTube or something. This is really wonderful material. So from understanding the experts, other people that are worth understanding are, first of all, of course, the attacker. Many of us are well aware that you can't build a secure system until you understand what the attacker does. And so the stuff that, for example, Martin, the criminologist, taught me from his debriefing of criminals, says, okay, I have this guy who used to be a thief. I want to see if this this shop is protected by the countermeasures they have. They have security cameras. They have a guard that looks like Schwarzenegger at the door. And so I rig this guy up with a hidden camera. And I say, go there and tell me, is any of this scaring you? And he looks at it and says, I could steal there anytime I want. Is this big guy not scaring? Well, no, I mean, look at the size of him. If I just grab something and leg it, he's never going to be able to run after me. It's too big. And another thing he says, going to this shop, there's inkjet printer ink. You know, this by milliliter, it costs more than champagne. So how about stealing some of that? You can think for yourself. These things are security tagged. You go through the gates and it goes beep, beep, beep. How could you steal that? I mean, imagine at least three ways you could steal something that's security tagged. And so I hope you're doing that now. And then this guy comes up with many more than that. He says, okay, first of all, of course, I could peel off the tag. I could open the box and just take the ink. I can still resell the ink as it is. I could, you know, put the whole box and tag into a tinfoil cover. And whatever it is they do at the checkout, that's already three, by the way, the thing they do at the checkout which zaps the tag, I could have one of these zappers in my backpack and I zap the tag as well. That's number four. I could just on the way out, not go through the gate, go to the side of the gates, then it wouldn't ring. I could actually just go through the gates, because most of the time they're broken anyway, they won't ring. I could go through the gates when the lady with the stroller is going, and then it will be blamed on the stroller because it's metal and all that stuff. Nobody really understands how these things work. I could also go through, and maybe it's not broken and it rings, and then someone looks for something, and I obviously exhibit my goods and stuff. Do you want to look into my bag? And once you give in to that, then they don't want to try and attack someone who's obviously a good customer and say, oh, sorry, it must be a malfunction because they have so many of these per day. And finally, I could just grab the thing and leg it. And what are they going to do? I mean, I've stolen this thing. They're going to run after me in the street. So, and that's already nine. This is the kind of insights that you have to be able to think like that. You have to learn to see for yourself if you want to build a secure system. But that's not the only type of person you need to understand. You also need to understand the victim of the scam. This is stuff that I learned from Paul, because Paul is the magician and scam expert who does this real hustle. And the point he drives home is that the smart attacker already understands the victim, because then he knows how to go after the weak points of the victim. And there's, I don't know how much time I got left. 3 minutes. Then I won't be able to tell this wonderful story in 3 minutes. The 5,000 ring scam, which is something that he showed on TV, a very elaborate scam which exploits the greed of someone who believes they're going to get some reward for returning an item to actually defraud them because the item was a fake. But anyway, I'm spoiling the story, but I wouldn't have time to tell it. The fake ATM is easier to say. They just put up a box in a shopping mall which looks like an ATM, and people put their card in, and there's a little lady inside who gets the card and gets the there's a computer that runs the display which says, sorry, your card is invalid, but at the time they've already taken the mag stripe and they've taken the pin that the guy has put in, and so they can then reuse them for making their own cards. And so in one case they exploit the greed of the person who wants to get the reward. In another case, they exploit the compliance with, you know, if it has looks like an ATM, has signs like an ATM, and it probably is an ATM, why should I ignore that? In other case, they exploit fear, other things, and these are understanding the victim is key to designing a secure system. And of course, understanding the user is also fundamental. This is some of this stuff I did a while ago. Some of this stuff I'm still doing as a consultancy work with consumer electronic design company. And the example I have up here is just trivial to drive the point home. Maybe it doesn't even need for this kind of audience. Imagine I wanted a secure but usable PDA. These are two somehow contradictory requirements. I want it secure, it means nobody else can access my data even if I lose it. And I want it usable, it means I can always access my data at any time without being in trouble. So in one case, it means I don't want to have, I want people to have a strong barrier against accessing any of my stuff. And in the second case, I don't want to have the barrier for myself. And usually when you have this kind of conflict between security and usability, the one that loses is security, because people disable the PIN. So people go for being able to do what they want as opposed to complying with the security, unless it's put in an unavoidable way, and then people don't like what this is. So I'm not going to talk about the stuff we are doing in this industry consultancy, but the point is that when you're dealing with what the designer does, the only way to get anywhere is to instill some respect for the user. So what the user wants to do is not something to annoy the designer, to annoy the guy who puts in the security. It's something that is a reasonable requirement to express, and is it's only going to lead to progress if the two work as partners, as opposed to one against the other. So this is the summary slide. It says nothing more than what I said in the others. That my standpoint now is that it's more important to understand people, and there's many types of people I'm trying to understand, than to understand the technology, which is the easy bit which you're taught in school. Thank you.
So, Peter, I was involved in the California Top and Bottom Review. I led the Sequoia source code review.
Yeah.
And subsequently, I led the review of the system that wasn't reviewed in California, ESNS in Ohio. In both cases, and I understand this to be true for the other groups that reviewed the other systems, the chief problem in writing the report of the reviews of these systems was making them less funny, because some of the vulnerabilities just seemed like, you know, punchlines to computer security jokes.
Right.
These systems were so bad. Our assumption was that, you know, this would cause people to trust these systems less and to have there to be calls for improvement. But I was surprised that there a rather common reaction, particularly among election officials, was to criticize reviewers for pointing out the flaws. And the argument is that you, by doing this, are reducing confidence in elections. And that is worse than having these flaws. Now, on reflection, that seems, you know, viscerally wrong, but I can't say precisely why.
Well, it's the old argument of security by obscurity, which we've been around in this community for 30, 40 years. What's interesting there, I think, is that you guys had to dumb down those reports a little bit because you were under non-disclosure agreements with the vendors, in part. And there were things that, if you wrote something that said, this is the worst piece of documentation I have ever seen in my life for this particular system, or if you wrote that the flaws in this system have been known for 10 years and remain unfixed, then the vendors start screaming bloody murder. The documentation reports were months late in being released because the vendors were all screaming bloody murder, saying that, hey, if you release this, you're going to destroy our business. And the Secretary of State was extremely concerned. On the other hand, the fact that you were able to release the documentation, I'm sorry, the analysis of the source code and the analysis of the red teaming studies was phenomenal. The fact that the Secretary of State had the vision to say to these vendors that you will play this game or you will not have your systems used in California was brilliant. I testified twice for her when she was still in the state Senate. And she said, you know, if these guys don't play along, I'm going to subpoena them. I'm going to make their lives absolutely miserable. What is interesting, I think, is that the vendors have all along been in bed with the developers. And when Dan Wallach and I and Rebecca Mercury testified for the Houston City Council 3 or 4 years ago, the election commissioner was totally, obviously in bed with the vendors. And she kept saying, look, there are three different versions of your vote in this system. How could it possibly fail to detect an error? Well, the point was that the first one was already wrong, and the second and the third ones were copies of the first one. So she was swallowing the Kool-Aid that they had been giving her. And the main complaint of Sequoia and Diebold and ESNS and Hart has always been, if anybody would find out anything about our code, it would diminish the security of the system. And this is fundamentally the security by obscurity argument. And it's bogus. It's absolutely, totally bogus. Now, I just had a little run-in with somebody who's pretty well-known in the voting community who was trying to submit a piece to RISCS saying that open source is inherently less secure than proprietary closed source software. And his arguments were just totally specious. And yet, here's a guy who's working for some of the election districts, and he's telling them in his good faith that these proprietary systems are perfectly good. So I think we have a monster situation here, that the only solution is openness and scrutiny of the systems. And I think the fact that Deborah Bowen in California was able to pull this off is one of the really remarkable things that have happened in the past 20 years that I've been fighting, 25 years that I've been fighting this problem. But the interesting thing is that other states have started picking up on it, and other states are, in fact, as
so
you know.
Just to clarify, we were very careful to negotiate that in both Ohio and California, the vendors didn't get any prior review of the reports.
Good.
I heard there are lots of issues today. I was having this talk. I'd just like to come to one of them about the apparent paradox of the government being prepared to please that that body should be seen by millions of strangers. I think it's a very interesting fact that it's not really a breach of privacy when they are strangers. We didn't care about what strangers did. If there was a video cam in the which showed me in my bath this morning, and it had been transmitted to everyone in China, I wouldn't have been a damn. If it had been visible to everybody in this room, I would probably have objected. What we care about are the people who form our local social community. And so we want to protect certain kinds of information which they might compromise us just from this local group. But the automatic assumption that strangers know things should be something we should be upset about, I think, is illogical.
You raise a very interesting point. I have a slightly different view of what you're saying, in that there are certain situations in which people are very private about certain information with people they know, other situations in which instead it's an actual stranger. So there is an anecdote of revealing very intimate details of their life to the stranger who happens to sit nearby on the plane. But there are also opposite situations in which you would reveal only something to a close friend and not to a stranger. So I see the point you're making, but I don't think it's so uniform that any information in relation to strangers by default is not risky or doesn't raise privacy issues. It depends on the type of information and the context.
There's a famous experiment I've read on on patients, fake patients being taken to the mental hospital. They pretended to be schizophrenic and contraceptive and they were treated as if they were schizophrenics. And they took detailed notes of the surrounding obsession, writing their clinicians. One of the most remarkable things they noticed was that the nursing staff, young women, for example, would treat them as if they were non-people. They would, for example, take off their shirts and adjust their bras and so on, because the schizophrenics didn't count as somebody it mattered to be. I mean, they behaved as if they were in private when they were actually with these non-people. And I think it's a very, this is the same issue about who we want to collect information from.
I agree. And again, the view, however, is that it depends on the context, the type of information, whether you feel threatened by giving something to a stranger or to somebody close to you. So I completely agree. I don't deny that phenomenon we're talking about, but I see it as one phenomenon, which as well as which doesn't contradict the, for example, the research by Victoria Bellotti, CEO of Spark. She worked on privacy as a psychological need that is satisfied when you are able to selectively reveal personal information to different people. So you are not sharing the same information that you share with your partner, with your professor. Not the same amount that you reveal to your professor, to your peers. Not the same amount that you reveal to your peers, to a complete stranger. And therefore, this ability to compartmentalize to a level the information sharing with different categories of people, including strangers, is what allows us to be functioning, well-functioning psychological human beings.
Because last time I worked for complete strangers, you don't give a damn. I mean, the population of Mars should know everything. Wouldn't matter.
Well, my comment is privacy by itself isn't much of a good. The issue is how is the information about us being used. We don't mind our dear family or friends or spouses, etc., knowing a lot about us. But to go back to something that Marcus Jacobson mentioned yesterday, as well, with this system that he developed, the problem is the ex-girlfriends or boyfriends or spouses. Because those are people who already know a lot about us and might have an incentive to try to hurt us. They are kind of dangerous. And, a butler, the more the butler knows about you, the better. But if a butler goes and tells, that's when you really get upset, precisely because the butler knows so much. Okay, so your families and other people have discovered to their cost in the past. So it really is an issue of control, of our being able to take advantage of this control. Now, of course, that runs into this issue that the Chicago School has brought out, where all that sometimes diminishes production in the economy, because it impedes the free flow of information, particularly all price discrimination have been emphasized as one of the aspects of it.
And to follow up on this, one example of some piece of information that you may share with a stranger who doesn't know you directly, but not with a close friend, a certain taste for a music band, which is particularly bad, probably, that you don't want somebody who knows you well to know that you listen to the kind of music. But if it's complete strangers, maybe you care less. Vice versa, your social security number, maybe you will pass it to your friend, because in a certain instance, he or she needs to help you out feeling a form that you could not feel otherwise, but you would not publish to a stranger.
My comments are directed to Mr. Adams, read the CCTV cameras. You mentioned that improving security should be, that is the announced intention of having them in place, but I would suggest that is accomplished by removing dangerous elements from society by identifying kidnappers, dangerous drivers, and killers, and leading perhaps to their arrest and conviction. So that would be a positive element. It's somewhat displaced from the original announced intention, but I would suggest perhaps it is useful in that function.
If CCTV cameras led to the apprehension of a significant portion of the criminals in society, that would indeed probably be a justification that it was reducing crime, not preventing an individual crime, but preventing crime in the future because it's taking the criminal out of circulation. However, for the last 15 years there has been a distinct lack of willingness on the behalf of the UK government to fund research into whether that is actually in effect. There's been some small-scale studies recently, and one study has shown that there is some reduction in certain types of crime due to the presence of CCTV. But it's not a reduction in the number of murders, it's not a reduction in the number of anything. It's a reduction in certain types of crime. It's premeditated, and a lot of the time it's simply displacement rather than an overall reduction. So, yes, if there was that effect, it's a bit like the if we had A, we could have B, if we could also have B. It's a nice idea, but it doesn't follow through in practice either, I'm afraid.
I'm speaking about identifying and catching criminals or offenders, and in this country there are two famous cases in which this was very effective. They are identified by means of CCTV cameras, so I just point that out.
If we took all the money we put in the UK, and I'm not saying this is valid anywhere else, we took all the money we put into CCTV in the last 20 years in the UK and paid for more policemen, who knows what the impact on crime would have been, or if we spent it on other impacts, such as relieving poverty in inner cities. If we put that money into different places, who knows what positive impact it could have had on the crime rates.
Correct. So I have three quick comments. I think the counter-argument to keeping the flaws secret improves security is that's inherently fragile. That there might be some short-term security increase, but it is wholly dependent on keeping that secret, and it's a hard secret to keep, and once it's out, you're done. So I try to use the fragility argument to fight against sort of the open disclosure is worse arguments. But to sort of Alessandro and some of the postings on the internet, I think we're seeing here is the technology moving faster than socialization. Because the things we see on Facebook and lastnightsparty.com isn't anything that college students haven't talked about to each other for centuries. The difference is it's no longer ephemeral. That there's inherently not ephemeral nature of today's communication technologies, which we use because that's where our socialization is, that I don't think people are fully taking into account as they're making decisions whether to post pictures or not. And there's some ex post facto justification or acceptance after the photo appears in the Daily Mail, saying, well, okay, I don't care. And I'm not sure how that'll change in the next few years as people start realizing that more and more people don't get into college or are failing job interviews because of things posted many years ago, if there'll be some kind of backlash. The third point about CCTVs, if I wrote an op-ed at The Guardian last week on this, and where I talked about the Jamie Bowler case, and I think it's another example of our tendency as a species to value story over data. That one valuable story, or James talked about two highly publicized U.S. stories, will make far more impact than a dozen scholarly studies saying that the reduction in crime rate is negligible. Which I think is what we have right now. And I write this in an op-ed. I almost get fired because I, unbeknownst to me, my employer is the largest seller of CCTV cameras. And I get an email from the CEO of the CCTV camera division telling me, I disagree with your data because I have firsthand stories saying how effective they are. And again...
The answer to that, of course, is the plural of anecdotes is not evidence.
but for people, the plural of anecdotes is evidence.
Yes.
Because it's salient, it's available, it pegs all of our buttons, and in a way data doesn't.
I would like to see some sort of political shift in the UK where every time somebody comes up with the anecdotes argument, somebody turns around and says, right, you've told me the anecdotes. Now tell me how. How is what you're proposing going to prevent what you're saying you want to prevent? Tell me how more CCTV will prevent the murder of James Bond or another James Bond. Tell me how. And that's the question which isn't asked.
Can I actually
present
some additional points to that? I mean, for instance, the Police Association's finding in that study, that published last week, and they basically said that it contributed, you know, and we're talking about, like, you know, a huge amount of money, I think it's 3%, 3% of crimes about, you know, because what I'm concerned about is, like, it's again, it's like focusing is, does the technology solve the problem? And the answer is no, it doesn't. It's not properly designed and implemented. You know, I mean, for every story you could give, I can give you 20, you know, where basically they just kept overwriting the tapes. When you look at the tapes, there's nothing there because, you know, because it's not usable. Or where even with digital technology now, you can't use it because the camera is just positioned in such a way, you know, you don't see actually see the person's face. You know, the frame rate, when it's being recorded, the frame rate isn't good enough, the resolution isn't good enough. They're basically having trouble, trees grow in front of the cameras, you know, and there's basically a huge bureaucratic procedure involved in getting the local council to cut the trees so it doesn't obscure the camera. There's just, you know, making something like this work is a big, complex problem. And the thing that really gets me so worked up is that nobody's interested in the homework that is involved to really get the benefits of this technology. It's always like, you know, putting the technology so small. No, it doesn't. It's an awful lot of other work you need to do. And that currently, in my experience, is
significant. So, if I may follow up on what Bruce was saying, I completely agree about this aspect of it. We have less and less ephemeral communication. I would add two characteristics. One is that now it's not only less ephemeral, it's also this instantaneous reaction. So that it's a message, an email, you have this very quick response, which may be emotional or rational, and for which there is then a proof, a documentation which could last for a very long time. Not only that, there is also this globalization effect in that if you say something very odd, outrageous comment here, and somebody picks it up with a camera phone, it could end up in a blog, maybe a small blog, the next day on a bigger blog, not because I'm a reporter, or simply because the sentence may be considered interesting because of its oddness, and then it could end up being globally known.
Do you want me to delete that thing, is what you're saying?
Yes, please. I was not saying. The analogy I use...
I'm sorry, can you repeat the quote?
The analogy that I use is that we have these faster and faster cars, which is information technology, but our ABS system is not developed at the same speed. So our ability to protect ourselves in a way to the speed at which information technology is growing. And there could be even evolutionary reasons for that. We were discussing that, right? We see the privacy, we react to privacy much more easily and frequently when it involves our physical space, when we see with our eyes or we detect with our ears some invasion. It's much more difficult when everything is free for digital technology.
I would love to send an 8 hours button on my email.
Okay, one last question.
Just follow up on something Matt said in comparing the e-voting to the terrorism discussion. We had some discussions that the overreaction to terrorism was possibly being more dangerous than the original problem, that was possibly more people being killed because they were driving or flying. There's at least a plausible argument that can make re-voting as well, given that as far as we know, the actual amount of election thrown by it seems to be small. The argument could be made that a good panic about e-voting, which nobody believes the result of the elections anymore, is more damaging than the actual
technical.
Mm-hmm. People say Mr. Evil gave up tonight.